Come on, darling,
croaked Jake, sweat dripping from his chin onto his shirt front as he stooped over the crank handle and spun it for the 100th time.
Don't let us down now, sweetheart.
Gareth scrambled up onto the sponson of Priscilla and took a long, despairing glance back over the turret. He felt something freeze in his belly and his breath caught. The elephant was 100 paces away, coming directly down on top of them, at a loose, shambling walk, the great black ears flapping sullenly, and the little piggy eyes alight with malevolence. Right behind it, fanned out on each side, pressing closely on the great beast's heels, came the full squadron of Italian tanks. The sun glittered on the smoothly rounded frontal armour, and caught the bright festival flutter of their cavalry pennants. From each hatch protruded the black-helmeted head of the tank commander. Through the binoculars, Gareth could make out the individual features of each commander. They were that close. Within minutes, they'd be overrun, and there was no chance that they could escape detection. The elephant was leading the Italians directly to the ravine, and their scanty camouflage of scrub branches wouldn't stand scrutiny at less than 100 yards. They couldn't even protect themselves. The Vickers machine gun was pointed away from the approaching enemy, and the limited traverse of the ball mounting was not sufficient to bring it to bear. Gareth was engulfed suddenly by a black and burning rage for the stubborn piece of machinery beneath his feet. He took a vicious, heartfelt kick at the steel turret. "You treacherous bitch!" he snarled. And at that moment the engine fired, and without preliminary gulping and popping, roared angrily. Jake bounded up the side of the hull, droplets of sweat flying from his sodden hair, red-faced, as he gasped at Gareth.
"You've got the gentle touch."
"With all women, there is a psychological moment, old son," Gareth explained, grinning with relief as he scrambled into the turret, and Jake dropped behind the controls. Jake gunned the motor, and Priscilla threw off her covering of cut thorn branches. Her wheels spun in the loose sand of the ravine, blowing up a cloud of red dust, and she tore up the steep bank and lunged out into the open, directly under the startled, outstretched trunk of the elephant. The old bull had, by this stage, suffered provocation sufficient to take him to the edge of a blind, black rage. It needed only this new buzzing frightfulness to launch him over the edge. The leisurely pace that he'd set up until now left his mountainous strength and endurance untouched, and now he trumpeted a ringing, ear-splitting challenge that rolled across the vast silences of the desert like the trumpet of doom. His ears curled back against his skull, and with his trunk coiled against his chest, he crashed forward in a terrible, ground-shaking charge. His speed over the broken ground was greater than that of Priscilla the pig, and he bore down upon her like a cliff of grey granite, huge, menacing, and indestructible. The captain of tanks had been shepherding the old elephant along gently. He didn't want him to tax his strength. He wanted to deliver to his commanding officer an animal in the peak of its anger and destructive capabilities. He was sitting up in his turret, chuckling and shaking his head with anticipation and growing delight, for the hunter's lines were only a mile or so ahead, when suddenly, directly ahead of him, the ground erupted, and an armoured car roared out into a cloud of red dust. It was of a model that the captain had seen only in illustrated books of military history, like an apparition out of the remote past. It took him some seconds to believe what he was seeing. Then, with a jarring impact on his already highly strung nerve ends, he recognised the enemy colours that the ancient machine was flying.
"Advance!" he screamed. "Squadron, advance!"
And he groped instinctively at his side for his sword.
"Engage the enemy!"
On each side of him his tanks roared forward, and for want of a sword, the captain tore his helmet off and waved it over his head.
"Charge!" he screamed. "Forward! Into battle!"
Now, at last, he was not a mere game-beater. Now he was a warrior, leading his men into action. His excitement was so contagious, and the dust thrown up by the car, the elephant and the steel track so thick, that the first two tanks did not even see the 15-foot-deep, sheer-sided ravine. Running side by side, they went into it at the top of their speed. were destroyed effectively, as though they'd been demolished by a 100-kilo aerial bomb. The riding wheels ripped away by the impact and the heavy steel tracks flying loose and snaking viciously into the air like living angry cobras. The revolving turrets were torn from their seatings, neatly bisecting the men at the waist, who stood in the hatches as though with a gigantic pair of scissors. Clinging to the rim of his own turret and peering backwards, Gareth saw the two machines disappear into the earth, on the great leaping towers of dust that rose high into the air to mark their destruction. "Two down," he shouted. "But another four to go," Jake shouted back grimly, fighting Priscilla over the rough earth. "And how about that jumbo?" "How indeed?" The Elephant, goaded on by the roar of engines and the crash of steel behind, and by the buzzing, bouncing car ahead of it, was making incredible speed over the broken, scrubby plain. "He's right here with us," Gareth told Jake anxiously. So close was the great beast that Gareth had to look up at it, and he saw the thick grey trunk uncoiling from its chest and reaching out to pluck him from the turret. "As fast as you like, old son. We'll have him sitting on your head." "I have told that idiot not to run the game down on the guns so hard," snapped the Count petulantly. "I have told him a dozen times. Have I not, Gino?"
"Indeed, my Count."
"Run them hard at the beginning, then bring them in gently for the last mile or so." The Count took an angry gulp at his glass. "The man is a fool, an insufferable fool, and I can't abide fools around me."
"Indeed, no, my Count."
"I shall send him back to Massawa." The rest of the threat trailed away, and the Count sat suddenly upright, the canvas chair creaking under his weight. "Gino," he murmured uneasily, "there is something very strange taking place out there." Both of them peered anxiously out through the rifle slots in the thatched wall of the blind at the billowing dust clouds that raced down upon them with quite alarming speed.
"Gino, is it possible?" asked the Count.
"No, my Count," Gino assured him, but without any true conviction. "It is the mirage. It is not possible."
"Are you certain, Gino?"
The Count's voice took on a strident edge.
"No, my Count."
"Not am I, Gino.
What does it look like to you?"
"It looks like..." Gino's voice choked off.
"I do not like to say, my Count," he whispered. "I think I am going mad."
At that moment, the captain of tanks, whose efforts to catch up with a fleeing armoured car and the stampeding elephant were unavailing, opened fire with a 50-millimetre Spandau upon them. More accurately, he opened fire in the general direction of the rolling dust cloud which obscured his forward vision, and through which he caught only occasional glimpses of beast and machine. To confound further the aim of his gunner, the range was rapidly increasing. The manoeuvres with which the armoured car was trying to throw off the close pursuit of the elephant were violent and erratic, and the cavalry tank itself was plunging and leaping wildly over the rough ground.
"Fire!" shouted the captain. "Keep firing!"
And his gunner sent half a dozen high-explosive shells, screeching low over the plain. The other tanks heard the banging of their captain's cannon and immediately and enthusiastically followed his example. One of the first shells struck the thatched front wall of the blind in which the Count and Gino cowered in horrified fascination. The flimsy wall of grass did not trigger the fuse of the shell, so there was no explosion, but nevertheless the high-velocity shell passed not 18 inches from the Count's left ear, with a crack of disrupted air that stunned him, before exiting through the rear wall of the blind and howling onwards to burst a mile out in the empty desert.
"If the Count no longer leads me..."
Gino snapped a hasty salute, and before the Count had recovered his wits enough to forbid it, he dived through the shell hole in the rear wall of the blind and hit the ground on the far side, already running. Gino was not alone. From each of the blinds along the line leapt the figures of the other hunters, the sound of their hysterical cries almost drowned by the roar of engines, the trumpeting of an angry bull elephant, and the continuous thudding roar of cannon fire. The Count tried to rise from his chair, but his legs betrayed him, and he managed only a series of convulsive leaps. His mouth gaped wide in his deathly pale face, but no sound came out of it. The Count was beyond speech, almost beyond movement. Just the strength for one more desperate heave, and the chair toppled forward, throwing the Count face down upon the sunken earth floor of the blind, where he covered his head with both arms. At that instant, the armoured car, still under full throttle, came in through the front wall. The thatch blind exploded around it, but the impetus of the car's charge was sufficient to carry it in a single leap over the dugout. The spinning wheels hurled inches over the Count's prostrate form, showering him with a stinging barrage of sand and loose gravel. Then it was gone. The Count struggled to sit up, and had almost succeeded when the huge, enraged form of the bull elephant pounded over the blind. One of its great feet struck the Count a glancing blow on the shoulder, and he screamed like a bandsaw, and once again flung himself flat on the floor of the dugout, while the elephant pounded onwards toward the far horizon, still in pursuit of the flying car. The earth shook beneath the approach of another heavy body, and the Count flattened himself to the floor of the dugout, deafened, dazed, and paralyzed with terror, until the commander of tanks stood over him and asked solicitously, "Was the game to your liking, my colonel?" Even after Gino returned and helped the Count to his feet, dusted him down, and helped him into the back seat of the Rolls, the threats and insults still poured from the Count's choked throat in a high-pitched stream. "You are a degenerate and a coward. You are guilty of dereliction of duty, of gross irresponsibility. You allowed them to escape, sir, and you placed me in deadly peril." They eased the Count down on the cushions of the Rolls, but as the car pulled away, he jumped up to hurl a parting salvo at the captain of tanks. "You are an irresponsible degenerate, sir, a coward and a Bolshevik, and I shall personally command your firing squad." His voice faded into the distance as the Rolls drew away up the ridge in the direction of the camp. But the Count's good arm was still waving and gesticulating as they crossed the skyline. The elephant followed them far out across the desert. Long after the pursuing tank squadron had been left behind and abandoned the chase, the old bull lost ground steadily over the last mile or so, until at last he also gave up and stood swaying with exhaustion, but still shaking out his ears and throwing up his trunk in that truculent, almost human gesture of challenge and defiance. Gareth saluted him with respect as they drew away and left him like a tall black monolith out on the dry, pale plains. Then he lit two cheroots, crouching down into the turret, out of the wind, and passed one down to Jake in the driver's compartment. "Good day's work, old son. You pranked two of the godless ones. We put the others in the right frame of mind. How's that again?" Jake puffed gratefully at the cheroot. "Next time those tankmen lay eyes on us, they'll not stop to count consequences, but they'll be after us like a pack of long dogs after a bitch." "And that's a good thing?" Jake removed the cheroot from his mouth to ask incredulously. "That's a good thing," Gareth assured him. "Well, you could have fooled me." He drove on for a few more minutes in silence towards the mountains, then shook his head bemusedly. "Pranged? What the hell kind of word is that?" "Just thought of it this minute," Gareth said. "Expressive, what?" The Count lay face down upon his cot. He wore only a pair of silk shorts, of a pale and delicate blue, embroidered with his family coat of arms. His body was smooth and pale and plump, with that sleek, well-fed sheen which takes a great deal of money, food, and drink to nourish. On the pale skin, his body hair was dark and curly and crisp, as newly picked lettuce leaves. It grew in a light cloud across his shoulders, and then descended his back to disappear at last, like a wisp of smoke, into the cleft of his milky buttocks, that showed coyly above the waistband of his shorts. Now the smoothness of his body was spoiled by the ugly red abrasions and new purple bruises which flowered upon his ribs and blotched his legs and arms. He groaned with a mixture of agony and gratification as Gino knelt over him, his sleeves rolled up to the elbows, and worked the liniment into his shoulder. His dark, sinewy fingers sank deeply into the sleek, pale flesh, and the stench of liniment stung the eyes and the nostrils.
"Not so hard, Gino, not so hard. I am badly hurt.
I'm sorry, my colonel."
And he worked on in silence, while the count groaned and grunted and wriggled on the bed under him.
"My colonel, may I speak?"
"No,"
grunted the colonel.
"Your salary is already liberal. No, Gino. Already I pay you a prince's ransom."
"My colonel, you do me wrong. I would not speak of such a mundane subject at this time."
"I am delighted to hear it," groaned the count. "Ah, there, that spot, that's it."
Gino worked on the spot for a few seconds.
"If you study the lives of the great Italian generals, Julius Caesar and..."
Gino paused here while he searched his mind in more recent history for another great Italian general. The silence stretched out and Gino repeated,
"Take Julius Caesar as an example."
"Yes?"
"Even Julius Caesar did not himself swing the sword. The truly great commander stands aside from the actual battle. He directs, plans, commands the lesser mortals."
"That is true, Gino. Any peasant can swing a sword or fire a gun.
What are they but mere cattle?"
"That is also true."
"Take Napoleon Bonaparte or the Englishman Wellington."
Gino had abandoned his search for the name of a victorious Italian warrior within the last 1,000 years or so.
"Very well, Gino. Take them."
"When they fought, they themselves were remote from the actual conflict. Even when they confronted each other at Waterloo, they stood miles apart, like two great chess masters, directing, manoeuvring, commanding."
"What are you trying to say, Gino?"
"Forgive me, my count, but have you not perhaps let your courage blind you? Have not your warlike instincts, your instinct to tear the jugular from the enemy, have you not perhaps lost sight of a commander's true role? The duty to stand back from the actual fighting and survey the overall battle?"
Gino waited with trepidation for the count's reaction. It had taken him all his courage to speak, and even the count's wrath could not outweigh the terror he felt at the prospect of being plunged once more into danger. His place was at the count's side. If the count continued to expose them both to all the terrors and horrors of this barren and hostile land, then Gino knew that he could no longer continue. His nerves were trampled, raw, exposed, his nights troubled with dreams from which he woke sweating and trembling. He had a nerve below his left eye that had recently begun to twitch without control. He was fast reaching the end of his nervous strength. Soon something within him might snap.
"Please, my count, for the good of all of us, you must curb your impetuosity."
He touched a responsive chord in his master. It voiced precisely the count's own feelings, feelings which had, over the last few weeks, desperate adventures become deep-seated convictions. He struggled up on one elbow, lifted his noble head with its anguished brow, and looked at the little sergeant.
"Gino," he said, "you are a philosopher."
"You do me too much honour, my count."
"No, no, I'm in it. You have a certain gutter of wisdom.
The perceptions of the streets, a peasant philosopher."
Gino would not himself have put it quite that way, but he bowed his head in acquiescence.
"I have been unfair to my brave boys," said the count,
and his whole demeanour changed, becoming radiant and glowing with goodwill, like that of a reprieved prisoner.
"I have thought only of myself, my own glory, my own honour. Recklessly I have plunged into danger, without reckoning the cost. Ignoring the terrible risk that I might leave my brave boys without a leader, orphans without a father."
Gino nodded fervently.
"Who could ever place you in their hearts or at their head?"
"Gino,"
the count clapped a fatherly hand to his shoulder,
"I must be less selfish in the future."
"My count, you cannot know how much pleasure it gives me to hear it,"
cried Gino, and he trembled with relief as he thought of long, leisurely days spent in peace and security behind the earthworks and fortifications of Chaldi Camp.
"Your duty is to command."
"Plan," said the count.
"Direct,"
said Gino.
"I fear it is my destiny."
"Your God-given duty."
Gino backed him up. And as the Count sank down once more upon the cot, he fell with renewed vigour upon the injured shoulder.
"Gino," said the Count at last, "when last did we speak of your wages?"
"Not for many months, my Count."
"Let us discuss it now," said Aldo Belli comfortably. "You are a jewel without price. Say, another 100 lire a month?"
"The sum of 150 had crossed my mind,"
murmured Gino respectfully.
The Count's new military philosophy was received with unbounded enthusiasm by his officers. When he explained it to them that evening in the mess tent, over the liqueurs and cigars, the idea of leading from the rear seemed not only to be practical and sensible, but downright inspired. This enthusiasm lasted only until they learned that the new philosophy applied not to the entire officer cadre of the 3rd Battalion, but to the colonel only. The rest of them were to be given every opportunity to make the supreme sacrifice for God, country, and Benito Mussolini. At this stage, the new philosophy lost much popular support. In the end, only 3 persons stood to benefit from the rearrangement: the Count, Gino, and Major Luigi Castellani. The Major was so overjoyed to learn that he now had what amounted to unfettered command of the battalion that, for the first time in many years, he took a bottle of grappa to his tent that evening and sat shaking his head and chuckling fruitily into the glass. The following morning's burning, blinding headache that only grappa can produce, combined with his new freedom, made the Major's grip on the battalion all the more ferocious. The new spirit spread like a fire in dry grass. Men cleaned their rifles, burnished their buttons and closed them to the neck, stubbed out their cigarettes and trembled a little, while Castellani rampaged through the camp at Chaldi, dealing out duties, ferreting out the malingerers and stiffening spines with a swishing cane in his right hand. The honour guard that fell in that afternoon to welcome the first aircraft to the newly constructed airfield was so beautifully turned out with polished leather and glittering metal, and their drill was so smartly performed that even Count Aldo Belli noticed it and commended them warmly. The aircraft was a 3-engine Caproni bomber. It came lumbering in from the northern skies, circled the long runway of raw earth, and then touched down and raised a long rolling storm of dust with a wash of its propellers. The first person to emerge from the doorway in the belly of the silver fuselage was the political agent from Asmara, Signor Antolino, looking more rumpled and seedy than ever in his creased, ill-fitting tropical linen suit. He raised his straw Panama in reply to the Count's flamboyant fascist salute, and they embraced briefly. The man stood low on the social and political scale before the Count turned to the pilot.
"I wish to ride in your machine."
The Count had lost interest in his tanks. In fact, he found himself actively hating them and their captain. In sober mood, he had refrained from executing that officer or even packing him off back to Asmara. He'd contented himself with a full page of scathing comment in the man's service report, knowing that this would destroy his career. A complete and satisfying vengeance, but the Count was finished with tanks. Now he had an aircraft, so much more exciting and romantic. "We will fly over the enemy positions," said the Count, "at a respectable height," by which he meant out of rifle shot. "Later," said the political agent, with such an air of authority that the Count drew himself up in a dignified manner and gave the man a haughty stare before which he should have quailed. "I carry personal and urgent orders from General Badoglio's own lips," said the agent, completely unaffected by the stare. The Count's stiffly dignified mien altered immediately.
"A glass of wine, then," he said affably, and took the man's arm, leading him to the waiting rolls.
"The general stands now before Amber Aradam. He has the main concentration of the enemy at bay upon the mountain, and under heavy artillery and aerial bombardment. At the right moment, he will fall upon them, and the outcome cannot be in doubt.
Quite right, nodded the Count sagely. The prospect of fighting 100 miles away to the north filled him with the reflected warmth of the glory of Italian arms. Within the next 10 days, the broken armies of the Ethiopians will be attempting to withdraw along the road to Dessi and to link up with Haile Selassie at Lake Tana. But the Sardi Gorge is like a dagger in their ribs. You know your duty. The Count nodded again, but warily. This was much closer to home. I have come now to make the final contact with the Ethiopian Ras, who will declare for us, the Emperor-designate of Ethiopia, Opia, our secret ally. It is necessary to coordinate our final plans, so that his defection will cause the greatest possible confusion among the ranks of the enemy, and his forces can be best deployed to support your assault up the gorge to Sardi and the Desi Road. Ah. The Count made a sound which signified neither agreement nor dissent. My men, working in the mountains, have arranged a meeting with the Emperor-designate. At this meeting, we will make the promised payment that secures the Rasi's loyalty. The agent made a moo of distaste. These people! And he sighed at the thought of a man who would sell his country for gold. Then he dismissed the thought with a wave of his hand. The meeting is fixed for tonight. I have brought one of my men with me, who will act as a guide. The place arranged is approximately 80 kilometers from here, and we will move out at sundown, which will give us ample time to reach the rendezvous before the appointed hour of midnight. Very well, the Count agreed. I will place transport at your disposal. The agent held up a hand. My dear Colonel, you will be the leader of the delegation to meet the Ras. Impossible. The Count would not so swiftly abandon his new philosophy. I have my duties here, to prepare for the offensive. Who knew what new horrors might lurk out in the midnight wastes of the Danakil? Your presence is essential to the success of the negotiations. Your uniform will impress my shoulder. I am suffering from an injury which makes travel most inconvenient. I shall send one of my officers, a captain of tanks. The uniform is truly splendid. No. The agent shook his head. I have a major, a man of great presence. The general expressly instructed that you should lead the delegation. If you doubt this, your radio operator could establish immediate contact with Asmara. The Count sighed, opened his mouth, closed it again, and then regretfully abandoned his vow to remain within the perimeter of Chaldee camp for the duration of the campaign. Very well, he conceded. We will leave at sundown. The Count was not about to plunge recklessly into danger again. The convoy which left Chaldee that evening, in the fiery afterglow of the sunset, was led by 2 CV-3 cavalry tanks. Then followed 4 trucks of infantry, and behind them the remaining 2 tanks made up a formidable rearguard. The rolls were sandwiched neatly in the centre of this column. A political agent sat on the seat beside the Count, with his feet firmly on the heavy wooden case on the floorboards. The guide that the agent had produced from the fuselage of the Caproni was a thin, very dark Galla, with one opaque eyeball of blue jelly, caused by tropical ophthalmia, which gave him a particularly villainous cast of features. He was dressed in a once-white shama, which was now almost black with filth, and he smelt like a goat that had recently fought a polecat. The Count took one whiff of him and clapped his perfumed handkerchief to his nose. Oh, tell the man he's to ride in the leading tank with the captain. And a malicious expression gleamed in his dark eyes as he turned to the captain of tanks. In the tank, do you hear? On the seat, beside you, in the turret. They drove without lights, jolting slowly across the moon-silver plains under the dark wall of the mountains. There was a single horseman waiting for them at the rendezvous, a dark shape in the darker shadows of a massive camel thorn. The agent spoke with him in Amharic and then turned back to the Count. The Ras suspects treachery. We are to leave the escort here and go on alone with this man. No, cried the Count. No, I refuse. I simply refuse. It took almost 10 minutes of coaxing, and the repeated mention of General Badoglio's name, to change the Count's stance. Miserably, the Count climbed back into the rolls, and Gino looked sadly at him from the front seat as the unescorted, terribly vulnerable car moved out into the moonlight, following the dark wild horseman on his shaggy pony.